from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Rachel Miro and for Dave Iverson. Our special series, Priced Out, continues today with a look at evictions in San Francisco. A new study by the San Francisco budget analyst finds the number of evictions jumped 38% between 2010 and 2013. Is this a crisis or a pale echo of the crisis that hit a decade ago? Is the latest tech boom responsible for turning San Francisco into an exclusive playground for the uber rich? Or is this just the latest chapter in a story that started with a gold rush? Our series, Priced Out, has been examining the ever-rising cost of living in the Bay Area and whether there's anything we can or should do about it. That's after this on Forum. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Rachel Miro, and today for Dave Iverson. You've heard this one before. San Francisco is too small and too pretty to house everybody who wants to live here. For buyers and renters alike, real estate has been heinously expensive since 1848. But it's become so expensive during this latest economic boom, many are asking if we've hit a tipping point. If middle-class residents can't afford to stay and landlords feel they can't help but evict renters to cash in on the market, what kind of a future are we building in the Bay Area? Our series Priced Out continues today with guests Sarah Short, Executive Director of the Housing Rights Committee of San Francisco, a tenants' rights organization here. Thank you for being here today.
Thanks for having me.
And Janann New, Executive Director of the San Francisco Apartment Association, representing rental property owners. Thank you for being here as well.
Yes, thanks, Rachel.
Well, you guys show up at a lot of events and panel discussions in the city, so it's good to have people who are familiar with each other and familiar with the arguments. Sarah Short, I'm wondering if you could kick us off by just explaining the latest report from the city's budget analyst that was written up at the request of Supervisor David Campos.
Sure. The supervisor who represents the Mission District, I think, had a particular interest in kind of getting to the root of this problem. Hearing so many stories, getting so many calls, et cetera. And so he commissioned a report from the Legislative Analyst's Office that showed really just what we've all, I think, been seeing. It was very validating. It showed that there's been a 145% increase in Ellis Act evictions in a one-year period.
Let me just stop you there. For the benefit of people who aren't familiar with Ellis Act evictions, what are those?
Ellis Act evictions are when a landlord evicts the tenant because he or she is removing the unit from the market. So the reason, one of the reasons Ellis Act evictions are so critically important and meaningful is that not only is the renter displaced, but we lose that unit permanently from our rent-controlled housing stock. And so that's one of the areas where we've seen the highest increase in that type of eviction.
And it's usually because the landlord wants to put it on the market as a condo.
Yes, it's usually a means for, you know, flipping the unit so that it's either converted to a TIC, which tenancy in common, which is what we call sort of condo light. It's another type of ownership, basically. So it's changing the use from a residential rental unit to an ownership unit. And obviously, there's a lot of profit to be made in doing that. But the thing that's key about Ellis Act evictions, I think, is that what we've seen now, and one of the reasons why we think there's a market increase, is that it's a tool that's being used by speculators. It's not necessarily your small mom and pop landlords who have been owning the buildings that want to get out of the business as it was meant to. It was created to serve
those facilitate.
Folks. Exactly.
Yeah.
Thank you. Exactly. Instead, what we're now seeing is people that they've just bought the building. They have not been the owners. They do not intend on continuing to be the owners. They've bought the buildings. They want to empty the units, renovate it, and sell it as TICs or condos.
Well, Janann New, I mean, you've been in the city now since the 1970s.
Yes.
Ellis Act evictions do seem to be a kind of market indicator. What do you read from this new report?
Well, I think that we in San Francisco need to take responsibility for this. And the one thing I saw in this report that I thought was striking is that we've created basically 13,000 jobs last year, which equates to probably, when you add all of these up, more than that. And we put 120 housing units, new housing units, on the market. So I don't think that we can continue this way without further cannibalization of the rental housing stock, because people want to come here. People are going to continue to come here, and they need a place to live. And some of the unfortunate aspects of rent control are that people are housed in way below market rate rental units, and there's a lucrative upside for people to sell those buildings, whether, as Sarah says, to speculators, or just sell them and get out of the market. And a lot of times the push for people wanting to own is there, and we need to house people.
Isn't that what suburbs are for?
Well, if you're a green person, like most of us in San Francisco, you don't prescribe to the tonic of moving out, develop. We are in favor of infill housing development here in San Francisco. We believe that there's policies that can be created to add more additional units. And I think that we need to seriously look at that and expedite some of the housing development.
When you say policy changes, what are you thinking of in particular?
Well, Supervisor Weiner has a piece of legislation that he has introduced at the Board of Supervisors right now in his District 8, Castro Noe Valley, that will allow existing rent-controlled building owners to add additional rent-controlled units in structures that have space to allow that. And a lot of our old attractive buildings have underutilized space in the ground floor that we can add very attractive units that are safe, habitable, and will be probably a little bit lower in rent, but rent controlled nonetheless. And I think it's these innovative type solutions that we need to employ here to house the people that want to live here. And Supervisor Weiner's the first person that I can remember in the past 30 years that has been able to add additional rent-controlled housing stock to the city.
Sarah Short, does that strike you as a good idea?
Well, let's be clear. When we talk about that they're rent-controlled units, the way rent control works is that those units will still start at the current market rates. And when we talk about what the current market rents are right now, I think everyone is well aware that they're astronomical. And so the starting point on those units, they may well be $3,000, which is the average market rent right now. And so, yes, it could do some help in creating more units for people who have that kind of money, and keep them away from, some of the other units.
Maybe let off some of the pressure to push people out.
Perhaps,
of
but it certainly
units.
Doesn't actually solve the problem that we're facing, which is that we're hemorrhaging low-income tenants who have been, a part of our city for decades and generations in some cases. And we need to do whatever we can to sort of plug that hole and make sure that we're not losing more of our residents who are being displaced entirely from the city. And many of them, if not that, are being made homeless. And so
I suppose it's worth mentioning, we're also talking about middle-class people, teachers, and other people who have been in apartments for years, maybe paying less than what the apartment would go for today, but still paying a substantial amount. But that gap creates that incentive
That's right. And what that gap is really caused by is the fact that we don't have what's called vacancy control. So that is, we don't have full protections within our rent ordinance, which would allow for caps on the rent at turnover. So as it stands, when a tenant moves from a rent-controlled unit, the landlord can raise the rent to market. And because market is, again, so extremely high right now, that's what creates the incredible differential. And that's what creates the incentive to evict, particularly long-time rent-controlled tenants.
I see you, Chump. I should point out we have Marla Bastian Knight on the phone, a tenant who is actually facing an Ellis Act eviction. Marla, thank you for joining us.
Yes, good morning. Thank you.
You emailed after hearing our last program in the Priced Out series, and I should mention we did try to contact your landlord, Urban Green Investments, and they didn't get back to us by broadcast time this morning. Can you tell us in short what your story is?
Our building was put up for sale in July of last year, and then November of last year, middle of November, it was bought by Urban Green Investments. And 1 week later, on Thanksgiving Eve, we received notice that their intent was to turn it into TICs, and we were given 10 days to respond globally, meaning we couldn't respond one by one, to a small settlement if we would move by June of 2013.
When you say small settlement, how much money were they offering you?
It was $30,000, which is about 21 more than that's mandated by the Ellis Act for relocation, et cetera. So no one responded because we didn't know whether it was a bluff or not. And two, there was nowhere to go. So they, in effect, were landlords for 1 week before they made their intent, and then they acted upon it on February 4th. We received notice that we were all being evicted.
And are you getting anything, given that you didn't collectively, globally agree to it?
No. Not that we know of, no. And
What happened to the other tenants in the building?
Pardon me?
What happened to the other tenants in the building?
Well, we're just sitting here. I mean, people are hustling to try and find housing, but we can't. I'm a retired City College teacher, and the rents for a two-bedroom apartment in North Beach are about $3,700 a month, which is more than my income. But what was particularly exasperating about Urban Green Investments is that we had, this is a 14-unit building, three of those units were vacant at the time of sale, and they could have done a value added and gotten market rate, but they chose to go for the biggest profit possible. Out of the 11 units that are occupied, eight of them are by seniors, and the other three have disabilities, so we had the year to try and hustle around. Personally, I'm on a waiting list for housing in Petaluma, because I had to, you know, get an hour's away from the city to afford something. But at the time of eviction, you know, these waiting lists are long. I was lucky even to get on a waiting list. And so I'm going to have to find interim housing. So it's going to be a two-stage move with putting all my stuff in storage.
Sarah Short, this sounds like the kind of speculation you were talking about earlier.
Urban Green is a perfect example. They are out of state developer who has come into San Francisco to prey on people like our caller, people like Mary Phillips, who's another tenant at one of their buildings, who's 97 years old, has lived in her unit for about 40 years. Her neighbor, Sarah, who's a public school teacher and a native San Franciscan, who are also in the very same situation because of Urban Green. They've gobbled up a whole number of properties throughout the city, and they're pulling the same exact trick in using the Ellis Act, just coming in, buying the building, using the Ellis Act to rid the building of tenants, doing these sort of sneaky tactics of trying to do buyouts and get rid of people without having to go through the courts. They're flipping them to make enormous amounts of profits. This is what we're seeing more and more. We're seeing a speculator who is not, you know, a landlord just opting out of the business. They've never been a landlord. They don't continue to be a landlord. There's one particular actor in the Mission, for instance, that bought 12 buildings, Ellis'd all of them, 55 different units. And 25 of those were all on one particular block in the Mission. What does this do to the fabric of our communities when we see whole swaths of individuals who have been living in our, you know, neighborhoods for years on end, who have given to the community and the city by being teachers, by being social workers, artists, and also all the vulnerable seniors and disabled folks who are forced to leave suddenly, and especially in a wave like this, you know, kind of en masse, you know, what does that mean for our city? What does it look like? How does it feel? And particularly, what does it mean about the future of San Francisco? And if we allow this to continue at the rate that it's happening, it's a 145% increase, as I said. Over 3 years, the Ellis Act number has tripled. And there's no end in sight. And I think that's part of the deep concern that we have, is that if we continue at this rate, we will hit the kind of levels we saw back in the first dot-com boom. And I think we all agree that that was devastating to our city in terms of the irreparable harm it caused and the displacement. And again, when we're talking about the Ellis Act, the loss of rent-controlled units permanently from our market.
Well, you know, I should mention again that we did try to contact Urban Green Investments, and they just didn't get back in time.
I am not surprised to hear that.
Jenna, I mean, it sounds like what we're hearing is that the market is just so rich right now that we have players coming in from all over the country, no doubt internationally, and that has been the case in previous booms. But they're acting more aggressively now, perhaps borrowing tactics that we saw Wall Street firms use during the housing boom in the last decade, housing boom and then bust. You know, big, aggressive, sort of clear-cutting approaches to vast tracts of land in San Francisco and elsewhere in the Bay Area.
Well, I mean, first of all, I think that there has to be some responsibility taken on the changes and further restrictions to the rent control law that the left has pushed forward over the years. The condo conversion law that we had and Sarah's group just ended protected seniors. It gave people a life estate in the building. It gave people options to buy into the units. And we told the city leaders that when that policy was restricted or ended, that it would result in the only way for people to have ownership housing through the TICs or the West Coast Co-op type buildings. And that's exactly what's happened. There's no more controls because the condo conversion laws have gone away. So it's a problem that the city needs to take responsibility for. The other thing is, there, according to this report, it's not like a massive evictions taking place. Last year, there were 64. The year before that, there were 61. In 2000, the height of the first dot-com boom, there were 384. So when you talk percentages, it seems like a lot. But when you look at numbers, it's really very few. And I would like to say that we joined with Supervisor Weiner in creating a Good Samaritan law, which allows for owners to bring people in through their own goodwill under circumstances like this of no-fault eviction, and offer rental units to people at below-market rents. Sarah was talking about how we have no vacancy control here, and of course we don't, but that lulls people into a false sense of security in rental units that for years they've been paying way below market rent. And you cannot expect a private owner to subsidize people in rental units, sometimes upwards of $3,000 to $5,000 per unit per month. No private owner is going to do that.
Sarah Short, I mean, we're asking, it seems, landlords, and, you know, not all landlords are big mega companies. Many of them are mom and pop operations, family operations. Are we asking them to basically subsidize people who, as, you know, endearing as they may be, are simply so far away from the market rate that it makes them untenable?
I think that question is irrelevant. I think landlords know what they've gotten into when they buy property, and they know what our laws are, and they've decided to sign up. And the truth is, we have such laws in place for very, very good reasons which without such regulations, we'd be an incredibly different city. We'd be the kind of city that all the new folks who work at Twitter and you know, in places in Mountain View and Silicon Valley would not be flocking to necessarily, because we wouldn't have the vibrancy, the diversity, the arts community, the general, quote, San Francisco values that we have here today. The rent control laws, I just think that's – it's sort of not on the table in terms of the value of preserving people's homes. We have very vulnerable senior, disabled folks, people with, families who are recent immigrants who there's just no way with the wages here that and the kind of jobs that are not those dot-com jobs that they would be able to afford the market rents. And we've already talked about the sky-high rent costs. And none of those people would be able to live in the city without our rent control laws. So,
are there any changes to the laws that you might make? Jananu was just talking about something they're working on with Wiener. Is there anything you would do if you could wave a magic wand to change the laws to account for the market forces we see flooding over San Francisco?
Well, of course, this issue of having some type of restriction or cap on the rents, and I'm not saying necessarily at the same level as the previous tenants were at, but something that cuts into the in tremendous amount of greed that's fueling the rent prices that we're seeing now, where it's like whatever the market will bear and we'll just push it up as high as that is. And it's just an extraordinary amount because of the fact that we have so many affluent people who can pay it. And so, unfortunately, that's a problem that we have because of state law where we can't just simply do that. But that's an example of the kinds of things that, we have these gaping holes, basically. The Ellis Act is another example where, unfortunately, we have some really gaping holes in our law, loopholes that speculators and landlords are using to exploit.
Let's let Jananu, talk about
Sarah,
the idea of capping rent.
Let me weigh in here. Let me have a minute. Landlords are capped on what they can charge as a rent increase. And for the past 5 or 6 years, it's 1%. So we can increase rents by 60% of CPI. So 1% a year. What is that? You know how much it costs to maintain these buildings in San Francisco, what the water bills are, the electric bills are, the maintenance costs, the seismic retrofit to make the building safe and habitable. Individual owners cannot possibly afford to keep up these buildings with a 1% rent increase a year. So now Sarah's talking about vacancy control on top of that. There's just no way. It's not tenable. And then it lulls the tenants into a false sense of security that they're paying $1,400 for a 3-bedroom apartment when market is $3,500. And the owner can't maintain the building. So what do? They get out of the rental market by selling the building to somebody else. And that person may be an owner to keep it as an investment, family-owned property for investment, or they may turn it into West Coast co-ops if that's a more lucrative thing for them to do in their investment strategy.
We're talking with Sarah Short and Jananu from both ends of the real estate market, landlords and renters. We're talking about evictions in San Francisco. Are you a renter with a tale to tell or a landlord? Eviction stories are typically complicated, but marshal your resources and give us the short and snappy version. Give Forum a call at 866-733-6786. And now that you have your pen or phone at the ready, 866-733-6786. You can also email us at forum@kqed.org or go to our website, kqed.org/forum, and add your comments and questions online. We'll be back in just a moment. This is Forum on KQED Public Radio. I'm Rachel Miro. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Rachel Miro, sitting in for Dave Iverson. This hour, we're talking about evictions in San Francisco. And if you've been listening all the way, you've been hearing a lot about the Ellis Act. We've got a link to an Ellis Act primer on our website, kqed.org/forum. If you're on Twitter, you can follow along with the Priced Out series by following the hashtag Priced Out. We've been getting a lot of comments online. Linda asks, isn't owner-occupied better for the community than renters? There are often new taxes voted in by a majority renter voting population but paid for by property owners. Seems like tenants have it too good. And then coming from the other side, Jim writes, what about the homeowner who simply wants to take a home off the rental market so that he or she can move into that house? Is that allowed without running afoul of the rent control board? We've got on the line, do either of you want to answer either of those?
Well, I mean, the owner move-in laws are fairly complicated here in San Francisco, whether you can move into a unit or can't move into a unit. And we highly recommend finding an attorney that's skilled in this area, because there are many protections of what unit you can move into, who you can or cannot evict to do so. So it's not an easy question to answer. It depends on a lot of other circumstances.
But simply put, it is a just cause under a rent ordinance to do an owner move-in eviction. So yes, there is an out basically for owners who want to move into their units.
This half hour, we've got on the line Jean, a San Francisco landlord who's asked that we not use her real name. She wrote to us as well after our last Priced Out program, expressing her concern that landlords are being unfairly represented in the debate over evictions and home prices. Jean, thank you for joining us.
Yes, I want to thank you for having this really excellent discussion. And I think that both sides, both Jeanette and Maria have made and Sarah have made excellent points, and there's valid points to be made on both sides. The point is, though, unfortunately, all the laws and the courts in San Francisco are geared towards protecting only the tenants. I'm a San Francisco native. My mother was. My family's been here for over 100 years, and the city has never been so inhospitable to families, artists, lower and middle class people. And mom-and-pop businesses can't survive. And those of us who, my mother bought a building here over 40 years ago, these laws weren't in place then. She thought, you know, that's what supported our family. And we are not part of the affluent class. Now that I have a family, I can't afford to move out of the one-bedroom apartment in this building. It is not easy to evict. We don't even want to evict. But we have people who have lived in the building, who have, you know, been born here, who have died here. We bring them, help take care of them when they're old. We bring them food when they have babies. And we have tenants who treat this like their home because it is their home. But we also have tenants who destroy the property, who harass other tenants, who steal and vandalize, and we can't get them out. And both of them, the good tenants and the not good tenants, pay, you know, some of them $900 a month. So the point about not being able to take care of the building, my mother trained me, always call in the fire inspections, make sure that the building is really safe, take good care of it. It takes us years and years and years to save up to do major improvements on the building. And it's something that we want to be able to do. We want to have, I really firmly believe that tenants do need to be protected against unscrupulous landlords, but landlords have no protection. And there are like good guys and bad guys on both sides. And I've been a tenant in this city. I've had terrible landlords, people who wouldn't repair things, who wouldn't do them to code, and they were unsafe. But I've also had good ones, just as we've all had, you know, good bosses and bad bosses. So owning a building, if you're a mom-and-pop landlord, is not any different than owning a bakery or some other small business. And it's we small business owners who, you know, I long for the old diversity that we had, and I want to contribute to my city. I want the city to have a whole diversity of people, and I want to be part of that. So I just welcome this conversation to say we have to make this equitable for both.
Jean, thank you so much for your comments. Jeanette, I mean, are there ways in which the laws can be tweaked to account for bad apples on both sides?
Well, I think that's a very difficult question to answer, because there's always ways that the laws can be tweaked. Some specific ways, it's very hard, as Jean said, for an owner to keep a building maintained when they're paying the high cost of maintenance and roofs and et cetera, as I made that point earlier. And then if you have tenants that are unruly, it's very tough to get rid of them. It costs a lot of money to go through the court system to evict them. Also, it's very difficult. We see owners in buildings time and time again treating their tenants like family, supporting them for many years, supporting them for below market rent, but my argument is that a private owner's responsibility or is that the government's responsibility? And I think that it's a very sad situation when people only get a 1% rent increase. How do they maintain the building? How do they subsidize those tenants? And then the tenants are lulled into a false sense of security paying such low rent.
But let me throw this question at you. I mean, if you're talking about a multi-unit building, there might be somebody in there who's been in there for 14 years. And then the gal who just moved in a year ago who is paying pretty close to market rates. Doesn't it kind of balance out?
In some instances, it does balance out. But in a lot of instances, you don't have people that move. People in our city will have some of the elderly folks, as Sarah was talking about, that need protections. We've supported protections for seniors. But, you know, they're living in like a 3-bedroom apartment and it's a single person because their rent is far lower than Efficiency Studio might be. So the rent control laws skew the market in such a kind of crazy, bizarre way that you have unit hoarding by people taking up too much space.
Let's turn now to the phones. We've got David in San Francisco.
Hi, good morning. A very good program. Several points for Ms. Shore. She tells us very real, very sad stories about people of low income who may lose their housing. I wonder if she's in favor of means testing for the wealthy tenants who are being subsidized. And a quick list look at Craigslist will show that people in the marina who have been there for 14 years are actually making a killing by renting out extra rooms. So that would be one proposition. Secondly, she keeps alluding to vacancy control. I wonder if she's really studied it in New York City. In some of the outer boroughs, the vacancy control became so onerous that landlords literally walked away from buildings. And that there's no reason to suspect that wouldn't happen in San Francisco.
Three questions. Can we start with the two and go from there?
Sure, absolutely.
Because those are big ones. Sarah Short, New York is, it seems, the other example that we can turn to. What lessons can we learn from that?
Well, as far as I know, New York doesn't have strict rent control. It's more rent stabilization as well. And there are some gaps within their laws as well. So I'm not sure if it's a best comparison point. But I want to speak to the issue of the, as the caller said, you know, marina tenants renting out spare rooms. I think if you look on Craigslist and you see more and more folks are renting out rooms, that's an indication of people not being able to afford their rent potentially, or their income's going down, or, I mean, all sorts of things. I don't know that you can do a cause and effect and say it means because these are loaded tenants who should then be means tested to make sure we don't have, you know. And I think it also speaks to a whole other problem that we're facing. One of the things that's going on here is we have to look at the context. Yes, we have 145% increase in Ellis Act evictions. But at the same time, we have a 38% increase in all types of evictions. And we also have, you know, Janann said the hoarding issue of hoarding units. Well, we also have people that have pied-à-terres in the city now. It's their second, maybe third property, a rental, you know, unit that they have, or they have it on top of a homeownership unit. We have people that are you know, doing the Airbnb thing where they're holding the units off the market and they're renting them out just as vacation rentals.
An unauthorized sublet, isn't that a reason for justified eviction?
Right. But I'm not saying what I was talking about right then was not the subletting room for Airbnb. It's the units actually being held off the market by the owner who is renting it as a vacation rental. We're seeing more and more of those types of things. And so you just have to look at the broader context. And then at the same time, we're seeing these stratospheric rents so that when these things happen, and this is important to note, is that when these types of evictions happen, the climate is such that people don't get to stay in the city. They have to relocate, as the caller, you know, said, an hour away from San Francisco to Petaluma. Or if they're very low income, they might end up homeless. It's a really different world than it was when at least, you know, first time around, there were some options for people to move to a different neighborhood, potentially to downsize their units, those types of things. But, you know, it's all over when you get that eviction notice right now in San Francisco.
So first of all, Rachel, I just wanted to state that we are in support of means testing. That's a really good way. The caller brought up a very good point. It's a good way to make sure that the people that do need rent control get rent control, and we're not delivering subsidies to rich people. The second thing is what we're finding with these travel websites is it's not the owners that are doing short-term rentals. It's the tenants in the building, or as Sarah said on unit hoarding, it's tenants that have a couple of units in the building and they're turning themselves into hoteliers or Airbnb or bed and breakfast providers, and they're subletting these units illegally. And if they get caught, yes, there's penalties, but you know, it turns our owners into the police department, which is what we don't want to be. We're housing providers. We're not going to search. But, you know, these tenants are breaking the rent laws, and there's no enforcement of these rent laws by the city against the tenants. So my owners can't rent for less than 30 days. That's the law. They abide by the law. But tenants are getting away with doing this on the travel websites and making loads of money.
Jananu, let me ask you about that question regarding New York. And Sarah Short pointed out that, you know, it's rent stabilization versus rent control. Are there any positives or negatives from the New York example we could use here?
Well, there's a lot of positive examples in New York that we could use here and we've advocated for in the past. New York every year does a housing study. And they put out a book of statistics about the market and what rents are, what exists, housing that's available. We should be doing that here. They have a collapsed housing department where they have a department of housing and everything is run through there. We're fragmatized here where we have several different departments in housing. Nobody knows what the other department is doing. New York has means testing and it's been very successful there over the past 15 years. Rent.
And just to stop you there, for the benefit of those who aren't familiar with means testing, how does that play out?
Yeah, means testing is that an owner will challenge a tenant. And for instance, the big example was Mia Farrow, who lived in a flat and was paying way below market rent. The owner challenged her need for rent control. And she produced financial documents. The owner produced financial documents. And it was decided that she no longer needed rent control. She can stay in the unit. She just needs to pay market rent. The other thing that New York has that's different than San Francisco is their owner-occupied buildings are exempt from rent control. Our owner-occupied buildings were put under rent control in 1991, and they were exempt prior to that. And it worked a lot better. It allowed for flexibility for mom and pop owners to cut deals with their tenants, feed their tenants, and not be punished for that. But since that happened, it's just been a year-by-year war between owners and tenants over control of these buildings.
David, thank you for those fabulous questions. I'm going to stop you at two, though, because I want other people to have a chance to weigh in. Sam writes on the website, San Francisco needs more subsidized public housing. Until then, rent control is the only reasonable, fair option to protect the poor from the economic whims of property owners. San Francisco's housing is simply too expensive, and any legal handout to the landlords only worsens that. What I want to pick out here, Sarah Short, is subsidized public housing. We know that with new developments, there's a small fraction of any new development that's supposed to be affordable housing. But, you know, there are so few new housing units put on the market. It just seems like a drop in the bucket.
We absolutely need to create more affordable housing. There's no question. I don't think even Jananne would disagree with me on that. We need a net gain. So there's no, to continue to build more affordable housing, which we have a lot of challenges in doing, and not preserve the very precious affordable housing that we have, which is our rent-controlled housing stock, at the same time, you know, would be not sensible. We don't want to be losing those units out the back door as we're creating more and just getting to,
It's an incredibly complicated dynamic. It seems like, you know, a butterfly moves in China and the rental market changes. Janann, what are your thoughts on subsidized housing?
Well, we do provide subsidized housing now, and we supported the Mayor's Housing Trust Fund that was voted in by the voters, which is a tax on ourselves to pay for subsidized housing. And Sarah's right. We do agree on this, but I think that there needs to be some consolidation that takes place in San Francisco. Sarah and I both will agree that our public housing here has not been well run for the past 15 to 20 years. When you have tenants in buildings that are seniors and don't have elevators that work for days at a time, Sarah and I will agree that's not a good way for them to live. So perhaps we do need to provide more subsidized housing, more all sorts of housing, but we also need to take care of and manage the housing we've already developed. So I would estimate there's probably hundreds of units that are offline that haven't been rehabbed and put back online so low-income people or moderate-income people can move into those units. And it's part of the dysfunction of the San Francisco housing market.
Quite a lot of people are writing about the dysfunction, and not so much with questions, but with comments. Eric writes, if San Francisco wants to distort the housing market, toward what population do we skew the bias? Everyone wants their neighborhood to not change as soon as they move in. Everyone wants to live with a water view, but not everyone can afford it. If we don't use a price mechanism to determine who should move where, then to whom do we give preferential treatment? Haven't other cities looked at this problem? High-density housing, yes. Rent control, no. Another listener writes, Ellis Act evictions are overwhelmingly done by new landlords, not the former landlords. Speculators prey on buildings that they can pick up cheap thanks to long-term tenants who have paid their rent for decades on time and then clear the building for tenancies in common. Turning now to John in San Mateo.
Hi there. I want to take issue with the idea of rent control being a disincentive for the landlord to take care of the building. With an example, so I have some close friends who moved into a large building downtown in the Tenderloin about 5 years ago, right before rents started to shoot up to their astronomical values now, although they were still pretty high. And since then, this building has changed hands by large investors several times. And we have, I've noticed the same units in this building are going for about 50 to 60% more than what my friends originally paid with their rent-controlled unit, which makes me think if rent control is, deters the landlords from maintaining the building, does this mean that since just in the past 5 years that the cost of maintaining this building has also gone up? I find that really hard to believe unless they're sort of gutting the entire thing and putting in luxury amenities, which they're clearly not.
Sarah Short, do you want to jump in there?
I think that's a very good point. The amount of money that landlords are able to make right now with the rapidly increasing rental market, it's well more than enough to cover, costs for a building. I think that, there are numerous costs to look at here. And one is the cost of, operating your building. The other is the cost to displacing long-term residents from communities that they've maybe lived in all their lives or for many years that they've and added incredible value to, and that they have their, where folks have their social networks and their community and their care providers, and what is the cost to that of that to our city, to our communities, to our families? I think it's, in my opinion, it's very clear. It's an unaffordable cost. It's unacceptable cost, and it's too high a price to pay for profits, you know, towards someone's business. So on the one hand, that's the other thing to look at is the stakes here. On the one hand, you know, there are landlords who are talking about, you know, their business model and the income they earn and, you know, how to kind of keep that going. On the other hand, we're talking about human suffering, and we're talking about families and individuals and lives and the ways that they are absolutely disrupted and leading to, you know, sometimes health concerns, sometimes, you know, breakups of communities and families and just, you know, utter destruction that's wreaking havoc throughout our city.
Janann, do you want to weigh in?
Wow, that was sounded like we were in the midst of another war, if you listen to Sarah. Okay, so first of all, let me address the caller's point. I did not say that building owners shouldn't or can't maintain their buildings. I'm saying it's very difficult to do it when you get a 1% rent increase a year, and the cost of maintaining that building, they have skyrocketed. So if any of you pay bills here in San Francisco, you know that your garbage bill's gone up, your water bill's gone up, your PG&E bill's gone up. The cost of getting any maintenance work has gone up. The cost of getting a latte has gone up. So, I mean, of course the costs have gone up. As far as Sarah's discussion about destroying families and blaming landlords for destroying families and, you know, causing tragedies, we have joined with Supervisor Weiner in trying to find units for people within their neighborhoods. So if they do have to move, we can go out and offer units, find them other places to live. The recent issue on Telegraph Hill with the Lee family, we found the Lee family a place to live at the same rent they were paying. Is it a tragedy that they had to move? Absolutely. I agree with that. I don't want to see seniors suffer, but we did find a unit.
Sarah, do you want to both bring up listeners to speed and explain why you think that's not true, the Lee family? Who are they?
Oh, yeah. The Lee family is a family in Chinatown, senior couple with an adult disabled daughter, and they were victims of the Ellis Act by a speculator, Matthew Miller, who came in and very shortly after buying the building evicted the tenants and, you know, is already doing construction on the unit so he can flip them to condos. This eviction generated a lot of community outrage because it's just really, I think, an illustration of the crisis. There was some delays in terms of when the sheriff would actually come. Ultimately, they did have to move. It took the will and the might of, I think, the mayor's office, the apartment association, all of those types of folks to even try to find them any replacement housing. As far as I know, the replacement housing that's been found is woefully inadequate in terms of the size, in terms of the location, in terms of the price. As far as I know, they'll be paying double the price of their unit that they had.
Janann, you're shaking your head there.
I don't think we need to, but I don't think that's the point. I don't think that's the point here.
Well, it is the point.
Whether the apartment association found one family who was in the news, a new unit, let's talk about what happens to all of these families when they are evicted. They do not have the benefit of the mayor's office and the apartment association.
Not everyone gets the benefit of a big chronicle.
Searching for housing for them.
Not everybody gets the benefit of a profile.
Maybe money should be put in, or efforts should be put in, to helping relocate people.
Absolutely.
And
that's
what we've been doing. We've been actively doing that. So I say let's make progress in a positive way, instead of, you know, parading all these tragedy. The Lees were paraded through the media when we had a housing unit for them. Was it woefully inadequate? No, it's a place I would live in. Why would we ever want to move people into not adequate housing? That makes no sense whatsoever.
I'll just say, I mean, it does. here's the thing, right? When you have a story that's sort of iconic, it's raising the issue not just specifically about the Lee family. We're talking about the broader issue. Clearly, we're not going to determine here whether the new home the Lee family found
right.
was
I
appropriate.
I hope Janann can find housing
price.
For Jeremy Michaels, for Mary Phillips, for
lots
Sarah
of
Brandt,
other
for all the other people who are in the pipeline right now to get it.
But
well,
you
I
know
hope
what?
To see that
I
happen.
I will try. I will try to do that, and I will say that we've delivered out of my owner's pockets this year so far $48,000 in voluntary subsidies through the Good Samaritan law out of the goodness of their own heart. So we will try to go out there and find them units, and I think we will be successful in some aspect.
So I guess you do believe in subsidies from private landlords, Janann.
Well, they're voluntary
with
subsidies.
With that, we've got about time for one more question. So I want to give Mike in San Francisco the opportunity.
Yeah, I just wanted to comment on earlier there was the idea that the a landlord knows what he's getting into when he buys a building. And, you know, I'm a big supporter of rent control. However, my wife's uncle had two tenants in a building in the Marina. And for 30-plus years, he never raised the rent. He was a wonderful landlord, and he got dementia and needed to go into assisted care, and the family needed to sell the building. And what I don't understand is that the two tenants are in there. They basically, the longer you stay, you earn basically equity in the building, because whoever wants to buy that building has to give these two tenants a huge payout in order to get them out of the building or keep them at $300 a month. Which, you know, no matter whether you're a teacher or whatever your role is in the community, at a certain point, there has to be some way to measure the fact that you have, you know, been the beneficiary of when you are a great landlord.
Well, thank you so much for your call, Mike. And one last comment now from Robert, who emails, San Francisco is a very tiny city. Other big cities in the U.S. are much larger geographically. It would be unthinkable for renters in Boston or New York or Chicago to be able to find cheap housing within just a couple miles of the business center. Why should San Francisco be any different? That's a fact of economic life. And with that, I want to thank our guests, Sarah Short, Executive Director of the Housing Rights Committee of San Francisco. Thank you for being here today.
Thank you.
And Janann New, Executive Director of the San Francisco Apartment Association. Thank you for being here this
morning.
Thank
you, Rachel. Thank you, Sarah.
You've been listening to Forum. I'm Rachel Miro, sitting in for Dave Iverson. Thank you for joining us.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation, and by a generous gift from Jan Schremm and Maria Minetti Schremm, founders of Clos Pegas Winery, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.